Well, for those of you who caught our video last week, Mike and I did not get taller. Matt lowered the table. We're back to discuss Mike's background, his strategies, and how you might benefit. Got you to stick around to shoot one more video, week two, for those playing along at home. This week, I wanted to get a little bit more into your background. How does someone end up in the chair of a portfolio manager? And then get into your funds, and not necessarily, you know, what you're buying and selling, some compliance concerns around that. But, you know, things like, we often get the question of like, well, I don't want to invest in value stocks. I want the growth stocks that'll go up, right? So we'll, you know, a little, understandably, our industry does a horrible job with nomenclature to try to make people understand what it is we're trying to do. But for those of you who didn't catch last week's video, Mike Shea, portfolio manager, colleague of ours, here at Hightower, runs a value stock strategy. Again, we'll get into what that is. A dividend champions strategy, we'll get into what that is. But first, how did you get into the industry? What brought you into the finance realm to begin with? It's 40 years ago. Number of stops, including Prudential, CEO, head of investment research, now portfolio manager. You've worn just about every hat. Tell us about the journey.
It was a long time ago. 1981, I'd been married about 4 years. I was in the insurance business. I didn't like it. I told my wife one day, I can't keep doing this. This is not for us. And I'd always had an interest in the markets. But how can I do that? I cold called the branch office manager of a Bache, Halsey, Stewart & Shields office in San Antonio, Texas. I asked for the branch manager. He actually came out, invited me in, and I said, I'd like to go to work for you. And it happened. Wow. To my absolute horror and shock. But it actually happened. I started as a retail financial advisor.
Wow.
I don't think we even called them advisors at that time. But that was how I started, just as a stockbroker, cold calling 200 people every day, trying to find a way to pitch ideas and build a client base and, you know, make a living, find a way to eat. But it was what I wanted to do. I was really enthralled by markets and had to find a way to be in it. And when I started in the business, it was before anybody knew that you could actually make any money doing it. It wasn't popular by any means. But that's where I started, and then one thing led to another, and I took a variety of positions after that within what became Prudential Securities, and moved through the ranks over the course of almost 30 years until I became the CEO of the business.
Let's grow. So cold call to CEO.
Yeah, a little different.
There's a lot. We'll have you back. We'll unpack that. Mostly, I want embarrassing horror stories of how one ascends.
Yeah, they're funny.
So how did you end up at Hightower, and why did you feel like that was a good fit?
I didn't think I would ever come back to work. I retired in
13-year retirement, lucky number 13.
It was just a little hiatus, just a short break of 13 years. I didn't think I would ever come back to work, and I didn't miss it. It was not a burning thing for me at that point. Stephanie called me in summer of 2020 and said, I think I'm going to go to work for this company you've never heard of, Hightower. I said, you're right, never heard of it. And she told me she would need some help. And I said, of course, I'm happy to help. And that wasn't what she meant. She wanted me to come along. Mm-hmm. And the thing that enticed me to come here was that there were two strategies that needed to be run by someone, mm-hmm. among other duties, but the opportunity to manage the value and the dividend champion strategies, something I had never done. Of all the jobs I had had on Wall Street, I had never actually managed money for other people. And I was intrigued by that. I thought maybe this would be the chance to prove that I know what I think I know. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the time to find out. Mm-hmm. And so I took the opportunity. I thought maybe this would be good for 2 or 3 years. I don't know, you know, if I can do it or whether I'll be able to or, you know.
Yeah.
So now I'm 5 years deep into this and it's gone well.
Yeah.
And I like the people here. And so I see no reason to stop doing what I'm doing.
No, we're appreciative of your work. And yeah, I think in a world, your world particularly, where there's a definitive metric at the end of the day, you've shown that you have what it takes. In last week's video, you mentioned you do it by yourself. Now, I'm sure you and Stephanie will chat and iron always sharpens iron somewhere, but you don't have a team of analysts behind you. It's you. Walk us through your process a little bit. How are you deciding what's going to go into a portfolio? Mm-hmm. How concentrated are those portfolios? There's a lot of closet indexers, they call them, and they just kind of buy everything. I know that's not you or Stephanie.
Right.
How do you build out a portfolio?
Well, we do have some resources now. We built some things in the ensuing 5 years, but we have a small team of research analysts who do work for us to help flesh out ideas.
Good.
They're generalists, so we don't cover the entire waterfront. We go where we think the opportunities are. My approach is this. We've all met people who know every statistic about companies. They can spew these things like on cue without thinking anything about it. If it was that simple that you just needed to know every fact and figure about the balance sheets and income statements, then everyone would beat their benchmarks, right? Except that's not the case. Statistics can all be calculated by algorithms, and they are. Mm-hmm. That gets processed into the market quickly. Mm-hmm. Great. That gets you average. Mm-hmm. This is an art, and there's always an art element to picking stocks. Like, okay, I know these facts. How much of this is going to be different in 6 months than what people expect? And what would the impact be on the price of the stock if those things happen? Now you're into the world of judgment and diverging from conventional wisdom. That's the art element of picking stocks, and there is a lot of that.
We talked about this a little bit off camera, but I think it all kind of dovetails together. On one hand, you have people who will point to, and this is kind of the anti-active alpha opinion, which is, hey, there's just so few publicly traded stocks compared to what used to be, and all the dollars are just kind of chasing the same kind of basket. ETFs obviously drive a lot of the flow. Talk about companies coming public a lot later in their lives on average, mm-hmm. the rise of computer, now AI. Where in the world is there room for a guy like you? And again, maybe it's this art comment you're talking about, but why is that not exactly the whole story?
Well, it's not even close to the whole story. Ideas hide in plain sight. You see it all the time. You go months and months and months with certain groups either acting horribly or not acting at all. They just sit there. And over the course of time, in many of those cases, the earnings of the companies keep going up, but nobody cares. We don't know why.
Isn't it? It's so interesting.
That's the fun part. It's like, why is this whole sector that maybe makes up 7% of the S&P just sitting here doing nothing? What does the market know that I don't know? And the answer to that is usually nothing.
Right.
They don't know anything.
Yeah.
They're just, it hasn't caught ignition yet.
Popular, yeah.
And there are cases like that that we've seen this year. The housing sector looked horrible. And then out of nowhere, a month or so ago, it came to life. We saw it in retailing. Retailing was dead, right? Because the economy was going to be bad because of tariffs, all the things that we talked about last week. Suddenly the retailers are reporting good numbers, and it's not turning out the way people expect.
That's been interesting, not even just retailers in general, but even retail space is having its renaissance, and this idea that we would never leave our couches and any kind of storefront. It's being reimagined, but again, it's evolving. Yeah.
Right. Here's another group that's sitting in plain sight. Energy. Mm-hmm. Who wants to talk about energy? Nobody. I just saw a few days ago, Delta Airlines decided to stop all flights into Midland, Texas. What's there? Permian. Mm-hmm. Why would that be? Because the Permian is bleeding out. Mm-hmm. It's depleting faster than anybody thought. Mm-hmm. Such that rig counts are down, activity is down, companies are selling assets. Mm-hmm. The Permian is not what it was when the U.S. was the leading producer of energy. It's changing. You can think a little bit ahead now as to what that may mean if conditions in the oil business get a little tighter than they are today. It's a good opportunity there.
Yeah.
That's the art, is thinking a little bit ahead as to what's sitting there in front of you that's being ignored that people may think differently about in 6 or 12 months.
I'm already feeling a video 3 coming on called Stuff We Didn't Get To, but let's get to your funds. Teed this up earlier. We'll tell people, hey, we want to tilt into value. We want to add this value fund. And I go, I don't want value. I want grow. I want stuff that's going to grow. There is this falsehood, although understandable, that the only things that go up in value are the growth stocks. So, mm-hmm. what is a value stock, and what where does it have a place in many investors' portfolios?
Well, first, let me say there's an element of truth to what people say about this, because they're defining it, I think, incorrectly. Mm-hmm. Value used to be viewed as manufacturing stocks, chemicals, papers, ag,
maybe a little financials.
Boring things, yeah. Occasionally financials, boring stuff. And the view is, well, that stuff never moves, which wasn't true. But there's another element to be considered. And I suffered with this for a long time before I came to terms with it. If you found a really great cyclical and it was a great value and you bought it and it went up 50% over the course of a year, it's like, okay, that's a win. Mm-hmm. Do I want to own Union Carbide for the rest of my life? No. Dow Chemical? No. But now I have to sell it and I have to pay tax on the gain, and I don't like to pay taxes any more than your clients do. And so there's a kind of a characterization in my mind as to how value and growth interact. And it's this way. Value and growth are not opposites. A growth company and a growth stock can be a great value, depending on the day of the week. Mm-hmm. And we had a great case of that in April. All of the leading growth stocks got smoked in Q1, all the way to the first weekend of April.
Well, we won't mention specific names, but I know from following along with you that you went and bought some things that no one would have thought would have shown up in a value stock. But you said, like, I never really get to buy this stuff, but I get to today.
Right. They're great. They were great growth companies at what I thought were decent enough values to justify being in my strategy. Mm-hmm. And now I've got the opportunity to be a full growth participant, but I bought it at the value point in time.
So the price you're paying. How do you distinguish the value strategy run from dividend champions? What's the difference between those two portfolios?
There are some subtle differences. Large cap value has more of a growth bent now. Mm. Dividend champions has some, but I'm more attentive to the income stream. Mm-hmm. I'm also attentive to the tax consequences and the expectations that people have in dividend champions when they buy those. They want the qualified tax treatment. They want low turnover. The idea is not to spin the portfolio mm-hmm. every day. It's to generate consistency and a good tax awareness.
When I was actually talking to a client the other day, he's like, I was actually doing some research. It looks like in the four quadrants, you don't want to necessarily just go buy the highest yielding stocks. Those a lot of times can be trapped. The companies that didn't pay dividends weren't necessarily the best performers over time. But those middle ones, and particularly companies that grow their dividend over time, is that true of your strategy? You're looking for those companies that have not only consistent, but have shown a proven ability to grow that dividend over time?
Yes. And even in some cases when the dividends are growing, if the earnings growth isn't keeping up, that's a little bit of a problem. So it's a little bit of all of those things. I like to have a few high yielders in the portfolio where they make sense, like in tobaccos, things like that. Those were very high yielders and have been huge winners for us. Those serve a role. Then I've got the middle ground where, I'm generating 3% or a little better in dividends. Big role for those. The value traps are all over the place.
Yeah.
For instance, in healthcare, that's been a very difficult group where the earnings have not kept up with the dividend payouts. And, we've stepped around those as best we could.
I hope the viewers have enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it. I think these should really be more like 30 to 60 minute podcast type things, maybe someday. For anybody who's listening, who belongs in your portfolio? What types of investors would your strategies be most appropriate for? Let's wrap up on that.
Anyone. Obviously, dividends may be more appropriate for a somewhat older demographic.
Yeah.
But anyone should be considering these as a way to mute volatility,
yeah.
diversify a little bit in style.
Yeah.
If you want to have a huge piece of growth, I'm all favor in favor of that. Yeah. But it doesn't always go in a straight line. And it's nice to be able to mute some of the market activity and the craziness that we see occasionally.
All right. Well, appreciate your time. We're going to see if we can get him to stick around, do stuff we didn't get to, part 3. But thank you.
Thank you, Tim.